Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Conscious Vibe Podcast,
where we elevate intellect through conscious dialogue
while exploring race, politics, business, and culture.
I'm Dr. Daryl L. Jones.
And I'm Charles D. Mitchell.
DJ the DJ.
What's going on, man?
What's happening?
You doing all right?
All is well, sir.
Loving life, man.
How are you?
Doing great. Fantastic. Good. So we have with us today Mr. Lawrence Hirsch, Esquire extraordinaire.
The got man two Esquire. Himself. There are two Esquires in the house.
Yeah, but he's the real guy, man.
Okay.
You know,
he's the smart one.
Yeah.
I got
And you didn't know this. The biggest DeAndre Ayton fan in the state of Arizona. Actually, might be in the country.
Wow. This is okay. We're off to a good start, my friend.
Okay.
The prominent divorce attorney in town, if anyone's listening. So, Larry, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a long time coming. I know we've discussed
this
numerous times.
Yes, we have.
Last time it was supposed to happen, there
he had to go to court, right?
Ended up being a court proceeding.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
such as my life on a regular basis.
It's good to have you.
We're happy to have you on,
friend.
Here.
Very excited about it.
Right before we both go to California and hang out, right?
which we will.
We will, exactly. So, look, Larry, give us a little bit of background. I know you grew up in Chicago. Tell us a few stories about that life growing up and what led you here to this particular moment, like, in life.
Well, that's going to take a really long time. But
we got plenty of time.
I grew up, I mean, the upbringing was not going to make for a very good story, but I grew up in suburban Chicago, North Side.
What's up, Northbrook? Was it? Okay. It's DePaul grad school, so yeah.
I grew up in Northbrook, went to Glenbrook North, did undergrad at the University of Iowa.
Cubs or Sox fan?
That's weird. I thought we were tight.
he's North, man. You got to be a Cubs fan.
I was messing with him.
So, okay. No, I think it's wonderful that Chicago has an unbelievably impressive baseball team called the Cubs and a great minor league team known as the Sox.
So now we understand.
So grew up in Chicago, went to University of Iowa, then went.
Can I ask when you graduated from Iowa?
I graduated from the University of Iowa in 1996.
Cliff King? Maybe.
That's why I'm asking. Cliff King, Larry Blue, Danon Hughes.
Of course.
All good buddies of mine.
Of course. I mean.
You know all those guys.
I am a third generation Hawkeye, and there are very few things in life that I take seriously. Iowa football, I assure you, is one of them.
So Cliff was also, what's the big high school in Buffalo Grove?
Stevenson. Yep.
Stevenson grad, too.
So.
Okay.
Yep. University of Iowa, Chicago Kent College of Law. Started in at a firm, bigger firm in Chicago, then actually moved out to Phoenix.
Knows our good friend
too, one of my exes,
Chicago
and then,
Kent,
and then BD. Billy Deck.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Graduated with Billy, then moved out here for a career change, which was interesting. Went to the Cronkite School at ASU to get a second graduate degree after my JD
in journalism,
broadcast journalism. Worked as a sports reporter and anchor for KOLD in Tucson. And then got sucked back into the world of law.
This is after your JD.
Correct.
You just reminded me of Adam Goodman. Remember?
Well, and then our next guest just graduated from with a broadcast degree. Literally coming in after you from ASU.
Well, it was funny. I mean, I left the law originally because I wanted to follow my heart. And my heart was wanting to be in broadcast journalism, particularly in sports. And ended up getting sucked back into law. And the reason is simple. It was money at the time. I mean,
yeah.
You know, people think that broadcast journalists or anchor people make a lot of money. That is not an accurate statement by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I think at the time that I had my job, the pay was $24,000 a year.
I've heard that.
Yeah, wow.
It was.
The pay scale is very different when you talk about.
Even some of the prominent names that we think make a lot of money.
I've been doing
some. But there are some who make a lot of money.
Yeah, there's probably 10, right? But then. There's this second tier.
But you've got to, what I didn't want to do was do that climb. Tucson to Boise,
mm-hmm. yep.
Boise mm-hmm. to yep. Charleston. Charleston, right. Maybe if you're lucky, to Baltimore, then to Philadelphia. And then by the time you're 45, now for the first time you got a six-figure gig.
Mm-hmm.
And that
no thanks.
That didn't seem too appealing to me at the time. Went and worked for J. Bergen Wilk starting in 2002, and it's 2022, and I started there in 2002 as a associate, and I'm currently one of our 9 equity partners. So,
how many lawyers were there when you started?
That's a great question. I think we had about 23 lawyers when I started. Now we're around 45. So growth has been exponential and excellent.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. What was the impetus for law school to begin with?
You want the honest answer?
Something tells me parents, but I want to leave it at that.
No, actually, I went to law school originally because I wanted to be an agent.
Got it.
And
okay.
That's so funny. So did I.
And really, it wasn't even that I wanted to be an agent necessarily in the sports industry, but I really wanted to be an agent in the music industry. And ended up repping one client during law school. Me and a buddy in my law school, we founded a little, it was called Image Sports International. We had business cards made. We thought it was incredibly cool. And then our client, who was a senior at Iowa State, pretty solid hooper, but he says to us when we're trying to get him to combines, he says, "Well, I got to fly first class." I look at my partner. We're both in law school, like on loans. We don't have the money to fly you coach, let alone first class.
What did he know about flying first class?
Television.
So
maybe some of his teammates.
Yeah, long story short, we did not end up finishing that representation. He ended up playing in Europe, and the rest is history. So. Now I have the distinct honor of being a domestic relations attorney.
Man, that's a hell of a journey.
It was interesting.
So were you an athlete in high school?
Athlete is, if it's in quotes, the answer is yes.
Wait till you hear this. We talked about this recently.
So, I played basketball for years. What was interesting about the basketball journey, I played point guard for a really long time. And then in seventh grade, actually in our neighborhood, there's a kid shooting hoops down the street. And so I ended up playing basketball with him, and he introduces himself and he says, "Hey, my name is Chris Collins. You may know my dad, Doug Collins. He's the new coach of the Bulls." Well, Chris ended up having a pretty stellar high school career.
Absolutely.
Junior high career.
Freaking garbage. What are you talking about?
Oh, my God.
So that ended the basketball career.
Garbage. Went to garbage. Tells you a lot about Larry's hoop skills. Garbage.
Then I ended up playing
Where'd you go to school?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, are we gonna go off on a tangent here? Duke, North Carolina?
It always goes off on a tangent. So, yeah.
So good. We already know that through high school.
Hockey, okay.
Yep. So that was that.
Were you an enforcer?
No, I was. All 5'6" of me enforced nothing.
You were a pacifier?
I was the guy trying to skate really fast.
Oh, go ahead.
To stay away from
a matador.
The much larger individuals who were on the ice.
That's some big dudes, man.
But there's something about staying close to sport, whether you're great at it or not, that's exciting, isn't it?
You know, sports to me represent so much more than sports.
Yeah.
And we could talk about this for hours and days. And I know Charles and I have spent many nights having some tequilas talking deep into sports. But sports is a microcosm of community. Sports is a microcosm of society.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So many of the ills of society are represented in sports, and some of the things that make life great are represented in sports. And that's originally why I wanted to get into sportscasting was actually to show the other side of the game. That's why I love soccer so much, is because soccer to me is so much more than just the game. It's the community. Yeah. It's the people. It's the passion. It's the politics. Everything.
I was just thinking about this whole dialogue around new media, which Larry would he'd be spot on.
He might want to stick around for that conversation, man.
Want me to just sit over here while people are talking about new media? I got a lot to say.
No, you might want to just stay and be a part of this conversation coming up, man. It's going to be deep. So, wow, man. So what made you finally decide, this is my passion, my dream, my vision, but I want to get into a different aspect of law?
To be honest, And it probably sounds bad, but I was good at it, and I'm still good at it. I think that there are aspects of being a more than competent divorce lawyer mm-hmm. that some people just have. You know, the law aspect of it is, if you're smart enough, the law aspect is usually pretty simplistic. I mean, if you're a lawyer, you can get through a case. It's the looking deeper at the psychology of your clients, the psychology of the other side, figuring out how to negotiate a deal, figuring out how to structure something where everybody wins. And those are the best settlements. That's right. Where everybody wins. And everyone walks away from that table equally disappointed, equally angry, and equally satisfied with the fact that their counsel led them down, you know, the righteous path of being done. And so I just, you know, I recognized, and other people in my firm recognized, that I had a talent in that particular arena. And I really thought I was doing a service to people. Some days are certainly more challenging than others. Mm-hmm. But you're helping someone through a really difficult, emotional time of their lives. And, you know, there is a, you know, there's a great deal of satisfaction that usually comes long after, but it's when someone comes back to you a year later and says, yeah, I know I didn't say it then, but thanks. Like, thanks for getting me through that. And, you know, that's something that's pretty special. You don't get that in corporate law. That's for sure.
How often do you get through these scenarios, right, where there's an outcome, good or bad? Obviously, you're looking for something that's going to be best suited for your client. But how often do you have an outcome where you look back and go, wow, I could have done a little better. There's something else I could have done here and there. I mean, I would imagine there's a little bit of that all the time. But I would imagine you to stay sort of in this in a way where it's not constantly bugging you, that you've got to have a way of minimizing that thought or that perspective.
Well, I think that there's two questions there.
Yeah.
And the first one, you know, you're a lawyer. You know, in a litigation case, especially anything that goes to trial, you're going to second guess yourself no matter how good of a job you did. I mean, I've been involved in trials where we, you know, absolutely ran the table. And that, you know, the night of the decision, I'm reading it again saying, oh, man, I can't believe that we didn't take this angle. We could have ended up with that, too. And that's, but that's a really miserable way to spend life and spend your practice. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty happy with the job that we do and the people in my firm do and virtually all of our cases. And, you know, maybe 15 years ago, I would have kicked myself constantly for not doing, you know, 100 of the right things out of 100, but as long as it's 98, you're in good shape. As far as I call it the separation of church and state. If you want to be successful in this particular practice, you had better get good at letting things roll off your back, because taking it home is disastrous.
Kind of like a jump shooter. Keep shooting.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, you said something earlier that just, I think it applies to a lot of industries and aspects of life where winning isn't perfection. And I think once we really let that absorb into ourselves, that winning doesn't represent our idea of perfection, but you can still win. And I imagine part of your role is convincing a client that this might not look exactly how you envision it, but you're still winning.
Yeah, because how do you define winning? You know, it's one of those words that's, you know, completely loaded. It's like it's my least favorite word in divorce law, and it's the word fair. You know, I get so aggravated with that word because
nothing's fair.
Yeah, well, better
what
yet,
is it? Yeah.
What is it? Someone says, well, I just want to be fair to the other side. And I say right away, don't use that word again to a client. They say, well, why not? I say, because I can almost guarantee you that what the other side thinks is fair is not what you think is fair.
You don't know what that is to them.
Exactly right.
So let's not use the word fair during this process. And the same thing with winning. You know, how do you define the term winning? Absent a contract where it's a defined term, everyone has a different idea of winning. And sometimes I think that the better lawyers have a good control of you know, this is what winning means to me. And it doesn't mean that my
right.
you know, client walks away with $50 million because you may have destroyed that person's life to get there. That's not winning.
You know, yeah, winning. And that's the thought I was just having too, is like, how do you, in, you know, these some contexts where your client really just wants to go for the juggler, right? And they just want to rip this other side to shreds. You know, all this is emotional, right? And how do you preserve humanity in those moments to make sure that, you know, someone is seeing a bigger picture about what this may look like or may need to look like down the road?
It is probably the hardest part of the job is, first of all, explaining to people that our judicial system is not set up for revenge. That's
right.
You know, our
right.
judges are not out there to make rulings that will, you know, satiate your needs to get to back conquer. At the other yes. side. That's just not the way the system is set up. You know, as I tell people all the time, principle is very expensive, and that's probably not a, you know, something that you want to pay for. But I think that I task myself with the responsibility of not allowing clients to go down that road.
Have you ever had to fire a client for just being completely unreasonable and not listening to your counsel?
I bet you can answer that question, sir.
You don't ask a question you don't have the answer to.
Absolutely. 100%. And in fact, I would tell you it's more often than you'd probably expect. Mm. Now, and sometimes you have that conversation and you get to that precipice and then a client...
Yeah, right, right.
Now,
right,
now
right.
I really get yep. it. Now I understand yep. that you're yep. not kidding around about this. But, you know, there are, and you get a reputation. There are a few lawyers within, you know, the high net worth complex case community who are scorched earth. And those are people you don't want to deal with. And I never want to be that person. I don't want clients who want me to be that person. Because I don't think that takes a high level of intelligence. That's just, you know, let's figure out how to burn it all down and go burn it. I mean, anyone can do that. That doesn't take skill.
Yes.
But yeah. I think that is the hardest part about the practice, is that people want their pound of flesh. And I try to do my best in explaining to them, you know, that's not what this process is about. You don't want to pay me to get that last pound of flesh. And you know, you got to balance that with, but we're certainly going to be advocates for you mm-hmm. in the strongest way possible. But we're going to, you know, I always like to say, we're going to be intelligently aggressive for you. And people, well, what does that mean? Well, it means we're going to be aggressive up until a point where we know that we can push the envelope, but we're not going to go over that threshold because typically it doesn't benefit you. You know, you're going to end up with a large bill and you're going to be unhappy and the judge is going to be unhappy and the other side is going to be unhappy and you're going to be mired in litigation for 3 years. How?
Yeah, how's that worth it?
Yeah. And for most people it's not, but.
So I was married once and I did it later in life and I entered into it with a prenuptial agreement. Had I gotten married younger, I wouldn't have. So I was very thankful that I had enough wherewithal sure. to pursue that. And I also had a fiance at the time who was very open to that, and to this day, wonderful woman. Can you at all talk about some of the misconceptions that come with a prenuptial agreement? When you say it, a lot of people's minds run on one end of the other. Can you talk about the importance of it and why it can make sense for both parties?
First of all, great question. Yeah. See, Charles, these are the types of questions I expect.
which means you're ready for them.
So, premarital agreements. I like to think that the best way to explain them is that this is to prevent problems later on. So many people approach it with, this is to prevent problems now, and this is for me to keep mine and you to keep yours and me not to give you anything. No, this is to preserve our sanctity and our friendship and possibly protect our children later on, whether it's 5 years Absolutely. Down the road or 15 years down the road. And it's always hard for people to see that. You know, that it's like, it's like an investment that isn't going to pay off for possibly 20 years, if ever. But I think that's the best way to look at premarital agreements, is it saves everybody from that process that we just talked about, everybody, you know, wanting their pound of flesh. Well, the premarital agreement will prevent that from happening. I think they are an incredibly effective and intelligent tool for virtually anybody. And, you know, it is made immeasurably easier when people have counsel. I think that's really key with premarital agreements, because if you have, you know, a premarital agreement and it's written correctly, it's a pretty complex document. And when you send it to someone who has never maybe been involved in the legal process, they're going to see it and, you know, mind blown. Whereas counsel can help talk people down. This is normal. This is a standard provision. Don't worry about this. But I think the younger generation is much more comfortable with premarital agreements than the older generation is.
Yeah, I can see that.
Boomers definitely are not comfortable. It was seen as a negative.
It's interesting because that's, to me, is no different than a business agreement, because those are the exact reason you get into a contract. If it's company A versus company B and you want to do business together, but we want to understand what terms and conditions that we're going to interact together, and how, if something happens on this end, how we're going to deal with it.
But Charles, this is not a business deal.
No, I understand.
Yeah. This is love.
But all I'm saying is the mechanics are the same, right?
Nobody wants to talk about that when we talk about marriage.
They are precisely the same. Yeah. I mean,
mechanics are the same.
You know, it's similar to going into your insurance agent and figuring out your actuarial table. And, you know, I mean, there's a shelf life and you're figuring out your own death.
Exactly right.
You know, in a premarital agreement, you are determining your divorce at that time.
And you know what? The day may never come, right,
where
you
need to deal with it.
And or someone who enters into that agreement on the lower end of the economic scale may not by the time that marriage ends, right? So things can change as well. The other thing I think which was critical is that it's not like there's this template running around that you have to adhere to.
If you make a decision,
absolutely. And that's the other part I think people need to really understand, is that you can include things that are important to you in that as well.
We've written clauses into premarital agreements that would make your head spin. Some of them quite inappropriate to be. I mean, I've seen, let's just say we've written provisions about people's weight.
Are you kidding?
Like, no. Are you serious?
Like what the weight has to be maintained?
We've written infidelity clauses.
Mm-hmm. Infidelity?
That makes sense.
So does
that
the
weight. That makes sense.
What gets difficult in an infidelity clause
is how many
clause.
Times you get to do it?
What? Think about when you're putting together this agreement and you have to define
what is
certain terms.
Oh, right. Define it.
Oh wow,
that's interesting.
What's infidelity?
Yeah, what is it?
Is it handholding? Is it an emotional relationship? Is it kissing? Is it more? Have fun with two lawyers trying to argue about the definition of infidelity when there's millions of dollars at stake.
So Larry, like, super fascinating. This is like obviously like an inside scoop that, you know, DJ and I don't get to experience with, you know, people in this realm of the law, if you will. But I know that you're more than just a lawyer. I know that there's other things that you care about. You and I have had a lot of conversations. Matter of fact, I think the last time we talked, you and I were planning to move to Spain, right?
I looked into it. And
just the two of you?
No.
Well, not maybe. Just the two of us.
But maybe.
Maybe. Yeah,
I mean, we love maybe. Our wives. We love our families.
Yeah, maybe. But at least we had some other destinations too.
Portugal also.
Yes.
Yes. Would be a good choice.
And the impetus for that was just the state of, you know, obviously we talk about this a lot, our country,
sure,
our politics, the sort of level of inequity that we continue to see in so many facets of life. And I know that's important to you. So let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the things that disturb you most about what you see and hear on a daily basis? Big question.
That is a big question. Are we looking at it from, this is a, like a life question,
wherever you
correct?
Want to take it forever. I think it's a life question, wherever you want to take that.
You know, I was having, I mean, we'll it's time to get serious, I guess. There's a lot. That's a loaded question, and
that's the reason I asked.
I think that one of the things that is bugging me the most is that it seems to me that this country is going in the direction of which it was never intended. I mean, right now, look at, we've got essentially tyranny by the minority. I mean, wasn't that exactly what the founding fathers set out?
I love that you're talking about the framework of this country's constitution. I love that.
I mean,
is that your favorite subject in law school, constitutional law? Maybe. No?
I don't know. A long time ago. I don't recall ever having an actual favorite course in law school.
I'm with you.
I think constitutional law was probably the most interesting.
For sure.
And my professor was amazing, constitutional law professor. And I'll tell you guys a story right at the end because y'all love it. It's a great story and terrible at the same time. But, you know, that concerns me. I mean, if you look at 2016 election, we had a president that was elected, that was elected via the Electoral College with a minority of the votes, right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't win the popular election. And he put in Supreme Court justices, which a president can absolutely do. But we're having decisions now that are made by a party that currently does not hold the Senate, the House, or the presidency, and was not the majority in 2016. And one of the things that we're seeing is that elections matter, that's for sure. On a small scale basis, that's one of the things that really bothers me. On a bigger scale basis, it is that we have lost the ability to have meaningful discourse in this country. And not amongst the people that I think we probably associate with, because I can have really respectful conversations with people that I disagree with, but I don't think that most Americans can right now. And again,
and is that because of apathy, or is it because they're not equipped to?
Now we're going even deeper. I think that a big part of it is because a unfortunate large percentage of this country is not equipped to have those conversations. One of the things that I always thought was a issue in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, was that you had a huge delta in the education between Israelis mm-hmm. and Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Palestinians might be acting one way, but that was how they were taught. Mm-hmm. That's all they knew. You know, the Israelis were saying, but what about this and what about this? And we can solve this way. And the Palestinians would, no, we can't solve it this way. We hate you. That's what we've been taught. That's what we know. And that, to me, represents a lack of education, or at least lack of a appropriate education. And I think, to some degree, we're seeing that throughout this country, is that people are not prepared to have meaningful discourse.
So, Larry,
people don't understand it's okay to disagree.
It's okay to disagree. It's the foundation for learning, quite honestly. If someone presented a counter argument to you that said what we're seeing today was the exact intention of the foundation of this country, what would your biggest argument against that be?
Well, it depends if we were talking from generalities or specifics.
Let's talk about it from the founding fathers' perspective.
So what you would be asserting then would be that the founding fathers actually wanted this level of, I don't want to say animosity, but they wanted to create a country where the divisiveness and the thought process were so different, but yet you could still survive together as one. Would that be, because I would ask, what would, if you're saying, well, the founding fathers were thinking
like
something
a
else,
day.
What would it be?
Yeah,
it's a question.
Because
what I would say is, if you look at the original Constitution, if you look at the racial construct, if you look at the economic platform. In my opinion, everything that's happening today actually is part of the vision. And we almost lost, but the founding fathers' vision got murky at times.
60s, 70s, 80s, okay, 90s, right? It started to get really murky to the point where it started to scare.
But what there I we would go, argue, there we go. But I would argue
I
that.
I think that's a very but fair.
Let me stop, pause 1 second. And if you think about it in those terms, then how would you respond to that?
Well, what I would say to that, though, I think you're probably onto something. But what I think is part of the reality is that they weren't thinking 200 plus years ahead.
Of course they
were. No. I don't think they would have ever, they were. I agree with you. They were thinking 200 years ahead. But they weren't contemplating this multifaceted society that had free people that looked like you and I, or that had immigrants who came from wherever.
That's my point.
They didn't have this. They didn't have that piece of it as part of their narrative of what it would look like.
It wasn't intended.
That's why I'm agreeing with his narrative, right?
But as a, and again, this is not at all to put, but I've actually always looked at it as just the opposite.
Coming back to
there's
roots.
There's a fight back towards the, exactly what you just said.
Go back to what they originally
there's
wanted.
There's always that been that force that's now much more prominent of, and this ain't why we built this.
We built this for us. Not necessarily.
For them. But that's why we have amendments.
33 of them.
Right.
Yeah. But that's being challenged now.
Correct. But I'm saying that's why we had amendments, which meant that there was a mechanism to fix the bullshit that was like.
And there's a mechanism together to go back to it, and it's called the Supreme Court. But so.
That's a lost cause.
It's a question, but it's not. It's nothing you really have to answer. Sure. It's kind of rhetorical in a
For
sense.
For sure.
But it's just a different point of view around those of us that I would arguably operate with a rational.
I think
mindset,
it's a
right.
very good, rational, intelligent yeah. point. And I guess it's just a different way of looking at it. So, you know, as far as other, I don't know how deep we want to get.
As deep as we can.
We're here, man.
You know, it's Weed. Just, you just look at some of the people, in, I don't want to call it in charge, but the politicians. And I mean, it's, you know, it's like I can't even fathom that this
Isn't
is
it crazy?
Where we're at as a people.
Because it makes no sense. It's not rational, right?
As the beacon of democracy and intelligence in the
but
world.
Are we a beacon of democracy? Have we ever been?
I think that we have been, yes. I definitely think so. And that's not American exceptionalism, because you will never hear that out of me. But yeah, I certainly think that if people around the world were asked to identify what is the quintessential democracy, I think 9 out of 10 would say the United States of America.
And what would be the best illustration of that?
I mean, you have a country that was founded on the concept of
and on the backs
freedoms.
Of what? And on the backs
certainly,
of what?
Correct. But, you know, you're asking what's the average person around the world going to think? And I think that they would think that America was the beacon of democracy, right or wrong. But I think that would be the answer that you would most often get. I don't know that we are moving towards a continuation of that, that's for sure. You know, but the individuals that are the congressmen, congresswomen.
It's insane what we're seeing now.
It's like, what was the movie where the guy, oh my God, I can't remember it.
You're out of order.
No, the guy was in jail, and it turns out that he was the smartest person left in the world. Idiocracy.
Didn't see it.
I didn't see that one.
You guys got to go watch it. Idiocracy was from Mike Judge, who did Beavis and Butthead. And Idiocracy was essentially the downfall of society. And there was one person who was smart.
It's amazing that Beavis and Butthead's creator would come up with that concept.
And so the guy that was left was incarcerated, but he was the smartest person left in the United States. And by the way, this smartest person was of minimal IQ, but he just happened to be the smartest person. And it was, you know, this whole movie about the idiots running the asylum. And, you know, that's where we're headed. And
Headed?
I guess that's a good point.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the disappointing thing about all of this is that, you know, I think you said it earlier. I think if you frame all of this, we can share all the things that don't make any sense or that are just completely in our minds, utterly irrational, and just don't make good common sense, quite frankly. The biggest concern for me is that we don't, as individuals, we can't hear one another. There's so much hatred for the other side and the divisiveness. And I think the major issue and reason for that is we don't care about one another. Our hearts are hardened. We don't care about, we don't love one another. Our ability to care for and have empathy for others would suggest that there's something on your end that makes you think and feel the way you should do. And if I care enough to listen and hear, I don't have to agree with you. But I can respect your perspective, and then we can move on, right? And we can figure out a way to disagree, and sometimes you're going to win today, and sometimes I am.
Isn't that a function or a result of capitalism and individualism and individual freedoms? Because I think what we saw during the pandemic to some degree was a failure of this capitalist society and these individual freedoms that we have. And I said, I always thought during it, I mean, you looked at the way that a lot of Americans were acting, where you would watch other countries and you're like, what is going on here? But it was a function of we've been living as, you know, individuals for so long.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't disagree with that. I think part of the individualism in this country has taken away from the core of community and the ability to really look out for and care for one another, right? That probably, you know, you take that and you extend it beyond the idea of love and caring. It's a massive problem. And we if we can't find a way to bring that as a part of the fabric of who we are as a people, to your point, we'll never fix it.
We've become, in this country, this weird, like what I call a hyper-individual. And I think the greatest example of that is it seems like today you have to be a Republican or a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Mm-hmm. That defines mm-hmm. you.
It does.
What about being a independent, free thinker
Absolutely.
Who has thoughts that the Democrats are wrong, the Republicans Absolutely. Are wrong, some of them are right? Yeah.
For sure.
We don't.
For sure. I would definitely say, you know, when I think about how I align myself politically, you know, there's things on both sides that I abhor, but there's things that that resonate with me. And, you know, and I would say I'm far from being in the middle, right? I'm certainly squarely on one side in terms of how I view big picture things in life, but at the same time, there are other things that on the other side of the coin that certainly attract me. But why can't we all have the idea that there are some things that are just good basic ideas that don't sit in your camp?
Well, winning in life is different for different people. But, you know, I think for someone in your space, who you're a prominent professional, you are relied on by many with critical aspects of their life, yet at the same time, you're a human being trying to figure life out. How do you personally reconcile all this?
Hold on.
That's what it's there for. That's your flourishing juice.
No, it was. It's that you've asked a lot of good questions today. And I think that might be one of the best ones because I remember looking, you know, back just a year or two ago, and probably 2 years ago, when the pandemic was at its, you know, at its peak, and I'd had a conversation with my wife, and I'd been thinking this myself, but like, I remember thinking right around January 6th, mm-hmm. You know, when storming of the Capitol, whatever you want to call it, happened.
The insurrection. Let's call it what it is.
The insurrection. The pandemic was full boat. My client load was unbelievable. I wasn't going into the office at that point in time. I'm working from home. I'm juggling a kid who isn't going to school all the time and in and out. And at times it was almost as if time stopped.
Right.
And that was the only way that the one thing that I found myself doing, because we were just talking about sports, is I would actually go and onto YouTube and watch old games. And that was all that kept me sane, was some thought process of sports. I would watch games. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I teared up while watching. I was watching the Cubs winning the 16 World Series. And I wasn't crying because of the World Series. I was crying because there were fucking people in the stands. Like, how?
They were what?
There were fucking people in the stands. Oh, okay. Fans.
Okay,
like, that's
I got you.
How screwed up we were. That's what made me happy, was seeing people enjoying themselves, having joy in a ballpark. We didn't know where the world was going. I mean, at that point in time, there was no baseball, no basketball, no hockey, nothing. It was just so weird. So it was really hard, and I don't have a good answer as to how I kept my shit together, because you talk about difficult. We were all dealing with our own lives.
Absolutely.
I'm dealing with people going through their divorces at the same time I'm trying to keep my own shit together.
Absolutely.
And it was not easy. And I saw a psychiatrist to help me through it. And it was wonderful. We had some really good, deep conversations. There were a lot of points in time where, he had to get me on the righteous track.
Good.
There were some tough times. And I don't mean that it wasn't tough professionally. Things were really great. We were doing great work for our clients. But it was like you had to keep it together for those 9 or 10 hours a day when you were working, and then try and figure out what you were doing thereafter.
I really wish that you and I had known each other then, because we could have saved you a whole lot of money on his patio or mine. You probably would have had a few more laughs, and you might be a co-host of the Conscious Vibe right now. You never know. But this has been great, man. We could go all over the place with this, and I'm happy we're having this conversation. We may have to have you back on,
because
there's so many more things we could hit. The one thing I do want to hit real quick before DJ asks you, sort of like our last question that we typically ask people, is that I want to know. Well, I not want to know, but you two, you're not as much so, Marcus. He's like Sir Mix-a-Lot these days, but. Avid golfer.
That's the last.
Avid golfer.
What's the
you guys got to get on the court sometime.
I would love to.
That was one of the things that got me through. I should have answered that question with golf. Golf helped me immensely.
It did, man. Same.
The ability to just go walk the course was.
Smell grass.
Oh, my God.
I mean, seriously, all that.
It was phenomenal.
Golf was golf, right? Yep. But then just out, you may have a buddy with you, and it's just like, man, I can just breathe.
Although I remember on the tee box, we were all standing, at the time, like 6 feet apart from each other. We have one guy go up to the tee box, and he would walk off the other way, and then the other person would go tee off and walk the other way. Seems kind of foolish now, but, at the beginning, you're like, I don't know. Seems kind of like the right thing to do. All right, I got a story for you guys, though.
Yeah.
All right?
Con law.
Now, this will be fun in this little vacuum that we have here. So I had, I cannot remember her name now, but she was a constitutional law professor, and she practiced a little law on the side. And this is my first day of law school. Okay, so this is, a whole bunch of amped up kids who were successful in college. And so she introduces herself. And she gives us her little background. So she is a lawyer. She's black. Her husband is an obstetrician. OBGYN. They have 4 children. They live in the city. So we're all introducing ourselves. And it comes back to me to introduce myself to the class, and I introduced myself, I'm so-and-so, University of Iowa, and I think it's really cool that my constitutional law professor is Claire Huxtable.
Didn't go over well. Didn't go over well at all, did it?
No.
Shit. She throw you a new asshole.
I thought it was funny at the time.
And so does some of your classmates, I bet. They probably giggle, too.
Not as many as you'd think.
No.
Not as many as he was hoping for.
I was trying to be funny.
Yeah, a little spark plug.
Lighten up.
Yeah.
It's law school where everyone's stressed out. Like, thinking, all right, you know.
What did she say to you?
Black woman.
You imagine you and I sitting there in the classroom
She's a lawyer.
Oh, shit. He's in trouble now.
And I'm like, you know, it fits. It's exactly the same. And no, it did not go over well. So I ended up doing all right in the class, but that was a...
Not your best.
What was her response?
There was none. Thank you. Which was all the response that was needed. Because if you wanted someone to put you in your place quickly, she did. And that was like a moment of, shit.
So what did... So your learning from that was what?
I think that was when I learned that life is sometimes serious.
And it's a Gary Linhart moment. Remember the story?
That humor, you know.
On the plane.
On a plane.
On a bigger scale.
Chicago, too.
Right?
Words matter.
Absolutely.
And that was one of the things that I learned.
A lot.
When I was a young lawyer. I thought, you know, I was very loose with words as a young lawyer. And I remember having a senior partner come to me and really sit me down and say, words matter.
Yes, they do.
You know, words are power.
Words matter in life.
And it's all we have sometimes.
And we look at this day and age, and I mean, words are
they definitely matter.
Really important. And you know, think about how words are disseminated today via Twitter and Instagram. And I mean, think about what those words do.
Yeah, I had this conversation with a close friend yesterday. Words matter.
And so life lesson learned. Luckily, it all ended up okay. But I remember thinking like afterwards, like, oh my God.
You didn't see any harm in it.
Yeah, it was funny. I mean, I still look back. I hereby stand by that statement. It was funny. I mean.
Funny to you.
You know, it was like just kind of one of those things.
Well, we both immediately responded.
Exactly.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I knew where that was going.
It didn't work.
Going nowhere.
So, you know, we can all laugh about it now. 20, jeez, I'm feeling old. 25 years ago? Yeah.
There you go.
25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, some lessons are learned the hard way. That's definitely one of them.
So, I mean, we can't thank you enough. It's been really interesting to hear someone of your status articulate your world and what you do and how you see it versus us from the outside sort of looking in. So we thank you for that. We have a couple of minutes. Is there anything that you wish we had asked you or that you would like to ask Charles?
By the way, that's not normally how he says that.
Or myself.
Just so we understand.
The first thing is, do you think that Kevin Durant will be a member of the Phoenix Suns? Because at some point in time, we're going to be watching this, listening to this.
Honestly,
in the future.
I can't put it beyond the realm of possibility. I don't know how you don't give up significant assets to make that happen if you're on the Phoenix Suns end. Look, I believe you give up DeAndre and Harbury. I think you're going to have to give up Mikal Bridges. And I think you probably have to give up one more player or at least give up some draft picks that are going to be worthy of somebody having. You're not going to be able to give up one. It's going to be at least three. But I think you also probably have to give up. You might if you lose Kyrie Irving to a trade, which I think is going to also happen in this scenario, maybe it's even Chris Paul that has to go too. So I think those are scenarios where this could possibly happen. I don't love it as a basketball guy. I don't love it. I don't love it because I'm not a Phoenix Suns fan. I want them to burn in hell. And so I would rather see Kevin Durant, because if they come here, they're going to win.
Jesus
they're going to win. They're going to be really good. And I don't want that.
I spent way too many years
having the ability to laugh at all my friends here and chastise them for having a shitty ass team.
Civic pride right here. This is our.
I have no civic pride, brother.
Leader of civic pride.
Aren't you a prominent business owner? Aren't you a prominent business owner here?
Yeah, but that's all about me.
Oh, Jesus.
No, it's all about people.
It is all about people.
Wow.
Nice work. Wow. Nice work. I like that. Nice work. I did say, I'll pay you later.
But a question for you guys. What is your goal
with this podcast?
Yeah.
Exactly what happened today.
Okay. Exactly what happened today.
Personally, for me, it's to have what I personally, subject matter experts, share their world from a practitioner perspective, but also those critical glimpses into their personal world, and then how the two marry. For me personally, that's the beauty of what we do.
And I'll be real quick, you know, I think it's exactly what DJ and I set out to do, literally when we were sitting on his porch and mine, during the pandemic and thinking about the idea of a podcast. And I think it was partly about elevating conversations around things that he and I were talking about in those moments, because I think the pandemic spurred a lot of dialogue around a lot of tables. And I think we felt like we were having this richness in terms of what we were thinking about in the moment that we really wanted to share with others and also learn from others. And I think that's part of what I enjoy most, is that there's not a single conversation that we have with someone here that I don't learn something. And I love learning, something I pride myself on, being a lifelong learner. And the more we do that, the more I wanna do more of it. And so that's what really excites me and wants me to continue doing more.
Well, you're a very good conversationalist.
Thank you.
This is very.
He is,
good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's very good.
I kinda think that was sarcastic, but thank you.
No. Oh, from, no, maybe from Darryl, oh, but from me.
No, neither one of us.
No.
Okay. You don't believe you are?
You and I have had
great. Do you believe you are?
Some great conversation.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely do.
But
so
yeah,
do we.
It's
great conversation.
We've had some amazing conversations that are incredibly meaningful to me, because as I get older, and I like to think more mature, but as I get older, I recognize that those are the important things in life. Like how much money you have in a bank account, it doesn't really matter when you die.
Nope.
How much richness you have in your life, the people that you surround yourself with, your friends, your relationships, the people that you can rely upon, people that you can give shit to when Durant comes to the Suns and we win a fucking title. Like, that moment is going to be epic for me.
Yeah, and I'm moving. For sure it is. And I think that's like the beauty of it all. Nothing like, you know, a great conversation, a lot of laughs, and some great tequila. So.
I was just going to say, and a couple tequilas. And
margaritas on my porch next week.
I'm looking
actually Saturday.
I'm looking very much forward to it. And, you know, I can't thank you guys enough for having me. And I know. And appreciate you having invited me to do this. It was, like I said, very meaningful. I wish that we had more time so we could dive even deeper into some of the topics. So
well, can we do it
back.
Again?
We'll do it again.
I would love to come back.
We'll absolutely do it again.
And
just even sports in Chicago and here. I mean,
so much. We got so much more to cover.
We didn't even touch Chicago.
Downfall of society. I mean, all of these things are.
Operation Say No More. We'll do
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Done.
Let's absolutely do it, whether it's on this podcast or outside of it. So
no question.
Love it.
Larry, thank you again.
Thank you, gentlemen.
And thank you, likewise, for joining us on The Conscious Vibe.
Thank you for joining us.
And check us out on tcvpodcast.com.